morning.
Good morning. It looks as if we've got the thing working. It's good to see you all. Fashions change. About 200 years ago, women used to look like this. Nowadays, they look more like this. Now, the woman inside the clothes is pretty much the same as she was 200 years ago. But the things she's wrapped up in have changed a lot. And science follows fashions too. Ideas, fashions come and go. About 200 years ago, almost all the world's geologists looking at this rock face would say, well, obviously here we've got a lot of material laid down very rapidly in water. And most of those geologists would have said, well, this was laid down in Noah's flood. Geologists today, almost all geologists looking at this would say, aha, here we have layers of rock laid down millimeter by millimeter over thousands of years or millions of years. The rock face is just the same as it was 200 years ago. But there's a completely different fashion in interpreting how it got there. Now, why did the original idea, this is obviously rapidly laid down in water, change to, no, this was laid down millimeter by millimeter over millions of years? Well, the idea changed because of a man called Charles Lyell, who wrote this book, Principles of Geology. And in that book, he put forward what he called the principle of uniformitarianism, or the uniformitarian principle. And he wrote it like this: no causes whatever have, from the earliest time to which we can look back to the present, ever acted but those now acting. And they have never acted with different degrees of energy from which they now exert. And he called this a principle. But notice it is a pure assumption. It purports to look back to the earliest times, to which we have no records, to which no observations. It's not science. This is an assumption. And notice that this assumption specifically denies a major event of the Bible. What is it? The Bible tells us that at one time there was an enormous flood which covered the entire earth. This says nothing happens in the past except what we're seeing happening today. Today we don't see any floods covering the whole earth. Therefore, that never happened. And on this, he, working on the work of others who'd gone before it, built up the geological column using that principle. And he would say, nowadays we observe that sediment forms at the bottom of the oceans at 3 millimeters per century. It's always been like that. So when we look and see how many rocks there are in the earth, we pile it all on top of each other. We say, well, to be so thick, built up at 3 millimeters a year, then it must be 600 million years old. And on these 600 million years, he imposed a story of a progression of life on the earth from simple to complex. Now, has anybody ever actually observed a progression of life from simple to complex? No, that's also a theory. We know it as the theory of evolution. So what he did was he said, if we find these simple life forms down here, we call those rocks Cambrian. And if we find these, we call it Carboniferous. If we find these, we call it Jurassic. So then he went throughout the world and said, well, where do we get the thickest layer of rocks with these fossils? And he called them the Cambrian, and he said, that's 100 million years. His whole system depends on interpreting fossils. Now, there is nowhere in the world where you get this sequence of fossils. Not one single place in the world do you see that sequence. In fact, there's only about 15% of the Earth's surface where you find even four of these things in the right order. You find bits from down here on top of bits from up there. You find them all jumbled up. Only 15% in the whole world where you find even four of them in the right order. This is a purely theoretical construct, and it's based on evolution and the story about the fossils. Now, the story about the fossils is when things die, they fall to the ground or to the bottom of the ocean, and gradually either they get eaten or they get covered up by sediment. And, well, we don't know how many get covered up by sediment, but maybe it's one in a million. But since we've got 100 million years for the Cambrian, we'll get 100 times the population of these things fossilized. Problem with that, though, is that scientists have attempted to watch fossils forming like this. They never do. Fossils only form in very, very special circumstances, and when they do form, they form very quickly. But it's very rarely and in very special circumstances, and yet, when we look in the fossil record, we find places where there are thousands of millions of fossils, like this fossil graveyard at Agate Springs, where they've all been washed in together and thousands of millions fossilized all at once. There are plenty of other fossil graveyards. There are many in South Africa. The Karoo is famous for them. Thousands of millions of fossils all formed together, and yet nowadays you struggle to find anywhere in the world where there is a fossil forming. Then there's another problem. You find places like this where you have tree trunks. These are 10 meters long. These are major tree trunks, but they're standing in horizontal layers of rock. If this was laid down 3 millimeters a century, how does it come about that they didn't fall over when they were in the first millimeter of sediment? And why haven't the woodworm and the termites eaten them? You can't put an untreated pole standing up for thousands of years. In 5 years, it's falling apart because of the rot. These obviously did not fall over thousands of years. They were very, very quickly. And then, what about this story of the creatures falling to the bottom of the sea or falling to the ground, gradually getting covered up? Well, here we can see a fish having his dinner. He's engulfing that fish there, swallowing it. And you can see the muscular activity going on as he's pushing himself forward to swallow that fish. And this was suddenly covered in so much sediment that it didn't even have time to relax its muscles. And not only that, but every fin and scale is in place. Fish decay very, very quickly. This was obviously fossilized very, very quickly, not over millions of years. And then you find other problems in the geological record. This is a piece of sandstone which comes from a quarry in Texas outside a town called London, and it's classified as Ordovician. And it's Ordovician because that quarry has got lots of these Pelecypod fossils, which are the index fossils. And if you find them, then it's Ordovician. That means it's 500 million years old. But there's a problem, because sticking out of this piece of rock, there's a piece of wood. Now that's a problem. This is spruce. And spruce isn't supposed to have evolved until about 100 million years ago. So how can we have the rock that's 500 million years old with wood that's only 100 million years old. There's something wrong here. This is supposed to be Triassic. Well, the geologists got over this by reclassifying and saying, oh, well, this is Triassic. They've knocked 400 million years off the edge with the stroke of a pen. But that doesn't get him out of the difficulty, because when this was broken open, you can see that that spruce sticking out is part of the handle of an iron hammer. And the problem is, the only creature that's ever been able to make iron hammers is only supposed to have appeared right up at the top recently. So in this one specimen, we have Ordovician, Triassic, and recent. This shows this whole story is wrong. It all happened at once. The Ordovician and the Triassic and the recent all happened at the same time. This story is nonsense. Well, it shouldn't surprise anybody that there are huge problems with Charles Lyell's story, because almost everybody, just about all scientists these days, accept that the Earth has been hit by at least one major meteorite. Now, there's a problem there. The Earth is not being hit by huge meteorites today. So this destroys the uniformity principle. The basis on which all those millions of years were reconstructed. So the scientists, realizing that and not wanting to make too much of a disturbance, they decided to make this as small as possible. And they came up with a size of 10 kilometers in diameter. That's still a very large meteorite. And these two world experts on meteorites, Ahrens and O'Keefe, Ahrens actually got a Nobel Prize for his work on meteorites, they calculated that a body this size striking the Earth would throw up hundreds of thousands of millions of tons of water as water, which would rapidly come down as rain, doing vast amounts of geological work. It would throw up hundreds of thousands of millions of tons of steam, which would soon condense out and come down as torrential rain, doing vast amounts of geological work very quickly. They calculated it would create earthquakes millions of times more powerful than any earthquake we know about. And they calculated it would raise a tsunami 3 miles, that's 5 kilometers high, which would sweep around the entire Earth at the speed of sound. Mm-hmm. Now, here we've got an architect's, an artist's impression of a very, very much smaller wave. It's obviously going to do a great deal of destruction very quickly. Now, NASA has artists who attempt to portray things like this, and NASA's artist produced this, which gives a pretty good impression of the size of this wave. It's towering way above the clouds, 5 kilometers high. But this gives no idea of the power of a wall of water moving at the speed of sound. This is going to not only wash away mountains, it's going to wash away whole ranges of mountains. It's even going to wash away continents. Well, although it's only become popular recently to admit that the Earth has been hit by major meteorites, the idea was first put forward by an Australian astronomer called George Dodwell. And he put forward this idea about 100 years ago. And he put forward the idea because of his work on the tilt of the Earth's axis. And he found that all the records going back to antiquity show that the Earth's axis tilt has followed this curve here. Now, there are some pretty impressive observers here. We've got Copernicus, we've got Ptolemy, we've got Thales and Hipparchus, Pythias. We've got some pretty big name scientists going back into the past. And we've also got results from the ancient Hindu world, the Chinese, and then we've got ancient Egyptian observations. We've got observations from all over the world going back 2,000 years. And Dodwell said, look, this fits the idea that the Earth was hit by a meteorite about 200 kilometers in diameter about 4,500 years ago. So he presented this to his scientific colleagues and they said, no, these observations cannot be accurate. We know that the tilt of the Earth's axis actually follows this curve. It's called Newcomb's curve. Well, how do the scientific community know that the tilt of the axis follow this curve? Well, because their theories say that's the way the axis tilt changes. Their theories give Newcomb's curve. The observations say something completely different. But they say our theories must be right. The observations must all be inaccurate. It's not possible that the Earth was hit by a major meteorite only 4,500 years ago. That would spoil the whole story of geology. All its millions of years would fall away. No, that can't be true. There must be a mistake in all these observations. Well, Dodwell wasn't convinced of that, and he looked for other evidence, and he found lots of it. There are many ancient temples that were built in alignment with the sun. This is a very famous one called Stonehenge in England, and it was aligned so that the rising sun would rise over the Healstone and it would shine down between these pillars onto the altar where the sacrifice would be killed at dawn. Now, plenty of astronomers have looked at temples like this, and they all say the Earth has followed Newcomb's curve, therefore, for the alignment to be right for Stonehenge, it must have been built about 1,900, 2,000 years ago. But the archaeologists hearing this say, no, that's nonsense. This was built by the Druids between 300 and 400 BC. The astronomers say, no, not possible to be in the right alignment. It must be 2,000 years. And there's been a big dispute. The archaeologists say it is just not possible that this is more than 400 BC. The astronomers always work on this curve, and they get their answers by following that curve. Now, there's a problem when you come to look at the biggest temple that was ever built. This is the great temple of Amun-Ra at Karnak in Egypt. And it's in ruins, but there is enough there to reconstruct exactly what happened. Now, the first part built was the inner sanctuary. And what happened was that every year, at sunset, at summer solstice, the sun got far enough along the western horizon, far enough north, to shine down an avenue of ram's head sphinxes through these pylons, into the inner sanctuary, onto the altar and onto the golden idol of the sun god at the back. And at sunset, just as the sun reached the horizon and the sun shone in down here, the pharaoh walked in, bathed in the sunlight, like the sun god incarnate. The sacrifice was offered on the altar and the golden idol shone in the sun. And we know this happened because it's all written on the pillars. Now, this was the first part built, and these were built by succeeding pharaohs. As each pharaoh took over, he built his addition. And this last part was put on by Ramses III in about 1570 BC. And this whole story, it's recorded on the pillars. The pillars have been deciphered. And we know from what it says on the pillars, this is exactly what happened. The sun, as it reached the horizon, it shone in through these ram's head sphinxes, through these pylons, behind us into the sanctuary. But there's a problem, because on Newcomb's curve, the sun never got far enough on the horizon to ever shine in. But if we look at the curve of observations, the sun gets in at exactly the right date. It's 1570. And you can see here why there's a disagreement between the astronomers. They say the sun shone in then, 1900 BC, but on Dodwell's curve it gets in just when the archaeologists say it was built. So there is lots of evidence like this from the ancient temples that this is the right curve, and this is pure theory, and it has missed something out. So Dodwell calculated that the Earth must have been hit by a body about 200 kilometers in diameter about 4,500 years ago. Well, I got off a plane at Johannesburg Earth Airport a few years ago. I'd been giving some lectures in Russia, and I saw this picture on the front of the Pretoria News. And the heading was, NASA scientists now believe the meteorite was 200 kilometers in diameter, exactly as Dodwell had said. And now if you look at NASA's artist's impression of this meteorite, it's very much bigger, 200 kilometers. But what I haven't seen is calculations showing how much water would now be thrown up, how big the earthquake would now be, and how big the tidal wave would be now. It would be a whole lot bigger. But even on the calculations from 10 kilometers diameter, we have a situation which just wipes out the whole geological story. Thomas J. Ahrens presented his results at a conference, and in it he said, from the transient cavity, a tidal wave about 3 miles high would envelop the entire Earth in 27 hours. And he pointed out, this raises a problem, because how can any air-breathing creature survive a tidal wave 3 miles high? Everything's going to get drowned. He said, how can anything have survived? You never hear that. What we hear is the meteorite throwing up dust into the atmosphere, blocking off the sun so the plants died and the dinosaurs died of starvation. They pointed out that the dinosaurs won't have time to die of starvation, they'll all be drowned. But that is not fashionable among scientists. Why not? Because it sounds just too much like what the Bible says. Amos chapter 9 verse 6, for example, talks of he that calleth for the waters of the sea and poureth them out upon the face of the earth. The Lord is his name. And the secular humanist scientist establishment does not want to hear anything about the Lord or what he does. So we don't hear of this. Now, the picture I showed you before, you'll see there are a lot of people here. They're all geologists, and they're all looking at one little layer there, 1 centimeter thick, and they say that is the sum total of the effect of this meteor. It made a 1 centimeter deposit all around the Earth. Now, just a minute, we've got tidal waves 5 kilometers high with power to wash away whole continents, And you don't make a difference of 1 centimeter. Isn't there something wrong here? Surely it's much more likely that the early geologists were right. This looks like all laid down in water. This was surely all laid down in the flood that was caused by this huge meteorite. And they say, oh no, well that can't be true, because in the geological record, we find places where there is clay which has dried out to the point where it cracked. How could that happen if the whole earth was underwater? And we find places here and there where there's sand that's been blown into heaps. How could sand dry out and be blown into heaps if it's all underwater? And we find other places where there are scratches in the rock. Now, the only thing we know of that causes scratches in rock is glaciers, because they're, and the ice carries along rocks which scrape on the ground underneath. So there must not only have been plenty of time for the clay to dry out and the sand to blow into heaps, there were even time for glaciers to develop. So this isn't a quick story at all. Well, what can we say to that? Well, we don't really know, because nobody has any experience of tidal waves 5 kilometers high, with no experience of earthquakes millions of times more powerful than any that have been observed. So we really don't know what happened in the flood, but we do have some experience of smaller earthquakes. And we've got a story here. It's a record from an American warship called the USS Walter Reed. And Lieutenant Billings there was an eyewitness to terror in 1865. And from the side meter wheeler USS Walter Reed in the harbor of Arica, which was in Peru then, but it's now part of Chile, he helplessly watched a nightmare unfold as an earthquake leveled the town. An hour later, the first wave of a tsunami slithered under his vessel and engulfed frantic survivors clustered on the wharf. Then the waters receded until the harbour floor lay exposed, leaving other ships lying on their beam ends, but the flat-bottomed Walter Reed remained upright. You see, if you've got water that goes up somewhere, it has to go down somewhere else. If it goes up 5 kilometres here, it must go down 5 kilometres in the trough. And if the ocean isn't 5 kilometres deep, then the bottom is less exposed. Now, Walter Reed, being flat bottomed, stood upright, but the other ships, they all keeled over on their beam ends, and the water just disappeared beyond the horizon. Well, let's see what then happened. The sun had set when the Walter Reed's lookout spotted the next wave. We made out a thin phosphorescent line rising higher and higher. Below it loomed frightful masses of black water, nearly 15 meters, 50 feet tall. The wave swallowed the Walter Reed for a suffocating eternity before depositing her 3 kilometres inland, high and dry once more. Well, a 15 metre high tidal wave is very powerful, absolutely terrifying, and as nothing at all compared to a 5 kilometre high wall moving at the speed of sound. Now, lots of scientists have been doing calculations on what would have happened. Edward Anders from the University of Chicago said even if it hit the ocean, the impact would have created a crater 300 kilometers across. A huge plume would have pushed the atmosphere aside, the fireball would have had a radius of several thousand kilometers, winds of hundreds of kilometers an hour would have swept the planet for hours. Now, just a minute, if we have got the ocean bed left completely dry for 27 hours before the next wave comes back, and if we've got fireball temperature winds of hundreds of kilometres an hour, isn't it possible that some clay could have dried out to the point where it cracked? Couldn't sand have dried out and been blown into heaps? And what about this story about the scratches in the rocks only being produced by glaciers? Well, it's been found that when you have earthquakes, you have mud flows, and mud flows also carry along rocks which scratch which scratched the rock underneath. So these could have been carried out not at centimeters a year by glaciers, but at 100 kilometers an hour by mud flows. Well, you bring this evidence to the geologists and they say, ah, yes, but there are things which show it really did take millions of years, like the Grand Canyon, for example. The Colorado River in here is eating this rock out at such a rate that it would have taken 19 million years to carve out that canyon. Well, maybe it would. But did the Colorado River carve out that canyon? We've got a canyon here called Engineer's Canyon, and that is not as big as the Grand Canyon, but it's pretty big, and it's got a river in the bottom. That river is called the North Fork of the Tuttle River. And this canyon goes on for kilometers. It's a big canyon. But this river did not carve out that canyon. This canyon formed in the Mount St. Helens volcano eruption. And there was an earthquake of about 5.3 on the Richter scale, which caused a mud flow which carved this out in one day. There's a river at the bottom, not because the river carved it out, but because it's now a drainage feature and all the rain congregates there and flows out. The Grand Canyon, in its upper reaches, shows this was not carved out by the Colorado River either, because there are meanders. And if you do experiments to see what happens with meandering water, you find that the meander will not cut down through anything hard. If it reaches hard rock, it cuts sideways and wipes the meander out. These meanders are something like a mile high, more than a kilometer high. And to do this, all that rock, everything had to be soft when it was carved out. So in order to be soft, it must have just been deposited. This whole lot was laid down very quickly, and before any of it had time to harden, runoff water carved this whole canyon out. The Colorado River did not carve it out over millions of years. And then let's look at this rock face. At 3 millimeters a century, this must have taken a very long time. In fact, it was observed to be deposited in one day, again during the Mount St. Helens eruption in May 1980. One day, in a comparatively minor event, surely in an event billions and billions of times more catastrophic, surely we're not going to get 1 centimeter. We are going to get a huge amount laid down in one event. Now, there are lots of other items of evidence that point to the fact that all this was laid down quickly. Any of you who've been to look at this meteorite will recognize it as the biggest known meteorite in the world, called the Hobber meteorite. There are about 300 meteorites which land on the Earth every year. Many fall into the ocean, many fall onto the land. All the scientists agree that in the past there would have been more, because there was more debris in space, much of it has been swept into the sun, much of it's fallen onto the Earth and the planets. In the past there would have been much more than 300 every year. But even if there were only 300 every year, then there should be millions upon millions in the rock record. And it's actually a hobby in America, quite a well-known hobby, collecting meteorites. These two have found many. This is their largest. They are common. But they are only found in two places in the geological record. They are found down here, right at the bottom of all this sedimentary stuff. It's the only place in the geological column where it looks like an old landform. And down here at this old landform, you find meteorites. And then all through this whole lot, not a single meteorite until we come right up to the present. If it were true that this lot took 600 million years to be deposited, there should be thousands of millions of them in this rock record. There should have been at least 100 just in the coal mined in the last century. But in all the mining that has been done, all the excavation, all the engineering cuts, not one. Down here, yes, at this original old landform, up there at the top, yes, but nothing in between. This was all obviously laid down so quickly that we did not have time to collect any meteorites. This whole lot is obviously very quick deposition. Now, when there's so much evidence and it's so obvious, why do the geologists still talk about things being laid down over millions of years? Why do they refuse to look at all this evidence, and there's very much more than I've had time to show you? Why don't they look and say, well, yes, this was all very quick deposition in a big flood? Well, the Bible tells us why they don't. If we look at 2 Peter, we see, knowing this, there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Does that ring a bell? That's exactly what Charles Lyell said. Everything happens the same. It's always been the same, right back to the beginning. That's what the scoffers say. Why don't they open their eyes when they see the evidence says that's not true? They willingly are ignorant of that by the word of God the heavens were of old and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. They are willingly ignorant. They don't want to know. Why don't they want to know? Because the flood was a judgment from God on sin. And if you are living in sin and you don't want to give it up, you don't want to know anything about the judgment from God. You want to turn your eyes away from all the evidence that there is a God who judges sin, and you look the other way and you refuse to look at the evidence. The only reason that geology carries on with its totally disreputed story, its refuted story, is because the practitioners of geology do not want to believe the Bible. They don't want to believe that unless they repent of their sins, they are going to be subject to judgment. A far more sensible way of looking at things is saying, we have deserved God's judgment. Is there a way out? And of course there is. Because God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son, that whoever believed in him, whoever believes in him, however much you have sinned before, if you will turn to him, he will save you, and you will not die, but have everlasting life. I think we might have time for one or perhaps two questions before we go on. Does anyone have a question? Yes.
Well, obviously the flood must have been very violent.
Very.
How would the ark survive that? Just out of curiosity.
Everything to do with the ark is a miracle. God's got his hand on it. How come did anybody ever build an ark? Because God was in control and he told his servant to go ahead and do it. How did the ark survive? Well, the Bible tells us that God can send his angels to bear one up in their arms so that he doesn't dash his foot against a stone. I'm quite convinced that God's angels took great care to make sure that that ark did not get smashed.